Good afternoon. The Mid-Atlantic Center for Children's Health and the Environment is one of 10 pediatric environmental health specialty units in the country. We are indirectly funded by the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry and EPA. They don't review what I say, they don't tell me what to say, and they probably disagree with some of what I say. I have also provided some information to various lawyers about potential health impacts of natural gas extraction. So, you've seen in some of the other presentations, there are various steps in this process where health impacts can arise. The drilling itself primarily, I think, presents a risk to the workers, although when drilling materials are left on site after the total decommissioning of the well site, there can be contaminated materials that will be there for decades, if not longer. With air pollution, we've heard some discussion about air pollution from the material recovered from the well itself, but we also have to remember that it requires quite a number of truck trips to get the water to the well site, to get the sand to the well site, to get other chemicals to the well site, and then to take the water away yet again. And then there are diesel generators on the well site, and all of this stuff can lead to the generation of ozone and particulate pollution. So to get an estimate of how many truck trips we're talking about, Dr. Ngrafia mentioned that sometimes it's 1 to 5 million gallons of fluid per frack job per well, and it takes 1,667 truckloads of water to bring that 5 million gallons in at about 3,000 gallons per truck, and it takes about 750 truckloads to bring in the sand if you need about 1.5 million pounds of sand, and you can bring 2,000 pounds per truck, and then each well can be fracked from 1 to 10 times. We've just finished talking about the natural gas itself, issues from the methane, the benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene, and in some sites, hydrogen sulfide as well. And some of this, as you've already heard, is released directly to the air, and others is burned, but then, of course, you have the byproducts of the burning, leading to precursors of ozone. You've got particulate matter from the diesel trucks and the diesel generators. The methane itself, which, as has been mentioned, is a potent greenhouse gas in its own right, volatile organic compounds, and then also coming up with the, quote, natural gas, because it's not a pure return of methane, are radon and other products as well. In terms of the various health risks of ground-level ozone on the one hand, to the left-hand side of the slide, and particulate matter to the right-hand side of the slide, you've got some fairly simple things like coughing, but also children who grow up in high ozone and high air pollution areas end up with smaller lungs than children who grow up in more pristine areas. Not so much that they're symptomatic when they're in their early 20s, but if you have less pulmonary reserve at 20, and you lose some degree of pulmonary function every year as you age, does that set you up at being as great a risk for chronic pulmonary disease when you're an adult? I don't know, but it's certainly concerning. Both the ground-level ozone and the particulate matter aggravates asthma both for children and adults who have that disease, and for adults with emphysema or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, whatever you want to call it. Both of those are aggravators of that. For adults, but not so much with children, because children don't manifest atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease in terms of myocardial infarction and stroke, there is a strong correlation between particulate matter levels in ambient air and death from heart attack and from stroke. There's some fascinating data from Texas, not at all related directly to research on areas where there's natural gas extraction, but more to areas in Texas where there's petroleum processing. And they have a birth defects registry in Texas, and there's a series of studies that link birth defects and proximity by zip code and proximity to sources of airborne benzene. And a paper in Environmental Health Perspectives earlier this year showing an association between maternal exposure to ambient benzene and neural tube defects, a paper in 2009 also from Environmental Health Perspectives showing maternal exposure during pregnancy and intrauterine growth retardation, and a 2008 EHP paper looking at an association between leukemias, lymphohepatic cancers, and hazardous air pollutants in South Texas. So this certainly raises the concern about exposure to ambient benzene in other settings. Water pollution can occur in a number of different ways in the material that is pumped into the ground, the material that comes back when that pumped in material is returned, along with naturally occurring radioactive material and salts. Then there are, it's a little hard to see here, but we may see it in another picture, these storage pits. And for any of you who are familiar with some of the environmental health hazards associated with confined feeding operations, the CAFOs, the overflow of the storage pits, the breaks of the storage pits, this is exactly analogous to that. We don't know everything that's in fracking fluids. One of the most extensive efforts was a data collection actually by one of the committees of the U.S. House of Representatives. And they found, this is just a very partial listing of what they found, but methanol, isopropanol, silica, of course, the sand, 2-butoxyethanol, ethylene glycol, various petroleum distillates, and other chemicals in fracking fluid. Some of these chemicals would otherwise have been controlled as hazardous air pollutants or controlled under the Safe Drinking Water Act, but because of amendments to those laws, they are not in fact controlled when they are associated with natural gas extraction. So what comes back up from underground? You know, there's stuff down there that gets dissolved by the fluids and brought back up. And Kyle was talking a lot about some of these chemicals, so you see the list here. And we have well-documented cases, both in Pennsylvania and in Texas, of migration of methane to tap water. This is information from Kyle, presented in a little bit different format than he presented it, but basically reiterating the number of chemicals that are in the effluent, not what's put into these treatment plants, but what's coming out of the other end of these treatment plants after the water has been treated. But we leave that away. So I'm a pediatrician. I deal with children. Some of what I've talked about certainly impacts on the health of adults as well, but I look at kids as a special population and children and as a population that needs additional environmental health protection. Kids have a longer shelf life than we do. If something happens to me and the end result may not occur for 40 years, you know, I hope I'm around 40 years from now. But if that same health impact occurs to a 6-year-old or a 14-year-old or what have you, that's a very different story. And, kids certainly are not finished when they're born. And if you look at myelination of the central nervous system, kids probably don't get finished until they're about 25 years old. And so during pregnancy, even before conception, during pregnancy, and throughout the lifespan of what we typically consider childhood, there are periods of vulnerability such that if there is an impact that alters a course of development, you cannot go back and redo a step that was disturbed. Children generally eat more, drink more, and breathe more per unit of body weight than an adult does. So if what they eat, what they drink, or what they breathe is contaminated, they get a higher dose of that contaminant. And at least very little kids have a greater body surface area per unit of body weight. And so if there's dermal exposure and dermal absorption, they may also, again, get a higher dose of what crosses the skin. In the first year of life, their ability of the skin to block chemicals from coming into the body is much less than that of an adult. So at least for the first year, they may have more problems there too. And then, of course, hepatic metabolism, renal metabolism are different in children. And if we are going to try and protect them, we need to take those differences into account. So if we're going to regulate on the basis of the sort of imaginary 150-pound adult male that is so often used as the model for regulation, aside from missing a lot of things that have to do with kids, we probably miss a goodly number of people in this room who aren't kids anymore. The pediatric environmental health specialty units, of which the Mid-Atlantic Center is one of 10, have tried to put some information together, both for health professionals and for the public. These information sheets are available at the PEHSU.net website. When I stopped by the Association for Environmental and Occupational Clinics, which is our financial agent in the exhibit hall an hour or two ago, they said all of these fact sheets were gone. So some of you have them already, and you can download them and print them and do whatever you want with them from our website. You're welcome to that. So one for parents and community members. This one probably needs to be redone, if only because it's a pretty sophisticated reading level for parents and community members. But we'll work on that. So while there's no data to document that there are widespread adverse human health consequences as a result of natural gas production using hydraulic fracturing, there are a number of hazardous chemicals that are used and that are produced, and a number of very plausible and in some cases well-documented routes of exposure. And I would argue that it's incumbent upon the drilling and energy companies to document that they can do this in a way that minimizes the risk to human health. It's not the responsibility of health professionals to document that they can't. They're the ones who derive the economic benefit from it. The community, the society as a whole should not pay for trying to figure this out. They need to reveal a full description of all chemicals used and the quantities of those chemicals. You will see over and over and over again, this is 1% or 2% of the chemicals pumped underground. 1% or 2% doesn't sound like much, but when it's 1% or 2% of 5 million gallons per frack job per times 5 to 10 per well times how many wells in Pennsylvania right now, times, Texas, Wyoming, et cetera, that's a lot of stuff. And so I will leave it at that and ask the rest of the panelists to come on up, and we'll all try and answer your questions, and I thank you all very much.